solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You're not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
The central question of the book is, how did a man so weak achieve so much change? So it's not just that he was running a minority government. His own party hated him. He had to report to Sonia Gandhi, right? And the crisis that India had, you know, from secession issues in Assam, Punjab and Kashmir, to a balance of payment crisis, to the fall of the Soviet Union, to Rajiv Gandhi's assassination. So here's a man with very little power. And Narasimha Rao also was, you know, had famously the charisma of a dead fish. He was a really boring guy. So a man with very little charisma, right? Very little raw political power, very little mandate, and facing an inbox from hell, made this kind of change, right? And that's really the heart of the book. And I push at it again and again. I think one, and you know, I could give many examples of it, but I think a core feature of why Narasimha Rao was successful was that instead of focusing on what needed to be done, he focused on how it should be done. And I think that's very important.
Welcome to the 30th Conversation at the Play to Potential podcast, a series of reflective conversations across three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I'm an executive coach, and I help leaders and organizations play to their potential by engaging with them during periods of high-stakes transition, personal and organizational. You could visit transitioninsight.com for more details. My guest this time is Vinay Sitapati, an assistant professor at Ashoka University. He's a PhD in politics from Princeton and has degrees from National Law School and Harvard University. His journey itself is an interesting one. From studying law to journalism to pursuing a PhD in politics to writing and teaching. But the primary reason for me to speak to him was the book Half Lion, a biography of our ex-Prime Minister, P.V. Narasimha Rao. The book is a nuanced and insightful read about leadership under extreme constraints and about how we could think about staying relevant over time and playing to our fullest potential. In our chat, we spoke about how Narasimha Rao grew as a leader, specifically his habit of reflection, how he managed to decode signal from the noise when he tried to make sense of his surroundings, what made him resilient given the number of ups and downs he's had in his political career, how he adapted his leadership style to context to be the fox, lion or mouse as the situation demanded, how not making a decision is often a decision in itself, and much, much more. At the outset, I must mention that if you want to listen to the conversation offline, say during an airplane ride or during a gym session or another time, you could access the podcast at iTunes, Google's podcast player, Stitcher, Savan, or any of the other podcast apps out there. Without further ado, over to my conversation with Vinay.
Vinay, thanks so much for making the time. Excited to be talking to you. Maybe a good place to start is get a sense of what your pie chart of time looks like today. Give us a sense of what you do and why you do what you do.
Well, I'm an assistant professor of political science and legal studies at Ashoka University near Delhi. So I live in Delhi. I teach, three times a week, but almost 50%, if not more, of expectations in the university are in terms of research. So it's not just teaching. So I am currently, I'd written a book a couple of years back, a biography of Narasimha Rao. And there are a lot of language translations coming out. So some of my time right now is spent looking at, the texts of different translations. So Hindi, for example, is coming out this week. So I'm just working with the Hindi translator on that. I can read Hindi unlike Tamil and Telugu, so I actually know that. I can also read American English. So the American version is coming out next month. Mm-hmm. And it's an academic book by Oxford University Press. So it also has an introduction for an American reader. And I'm also working on a book currently on the on the electoral history of Hindu nationalism, on parties such as Hindu Mahasabha, Jan Sangh, and of course the early years of the BJP. So it's a mix of teaching and research.
Got it. And we'll get to Narasimha Rao. That's going to be the bulk of our conversation. But one of the pieces I'm curious about in the context of this podcast is how people have made career choices. You started out in law, then you went to Harvard Law School for a master's, and then you practiced as a journalist.
and now you're doing what you're doing. Give us a sense of how you've thought about the various forks in the road, maybe after 12th.
Well, so to give you some sense, like I'm sure with the others on the podcast, at the time you're making the transition, at the time the fork in the road presents itself, you typically go through instinct, or you know, you're not really rationally thinking through, you know, what lies on either end of that, of those two choices. But looking back, I can just think of myself, you know, basically focusing on, look, am I enjoying myself? And am I growing? You know, and am I being relevant? I think these are the three things that, looking back, that I tried to ask myself at these three forks. And, you know, look, I'm only 34, so I don't have all that many forks. And, you know, I don't know the end of the road in many of those forks, right? So, you know, please keep that in mind, that unlike your other guests on this podcast, you know, I'm not a success story that you're now reverse engineering to find out that what worked, right? Sure. But if I were to just look back at my limited career and limited life, I could think of three forks. The first is when I finished my 12th standard. Now, unusually, I had taken classes in fine art, painting, as well as in science. And even then, I had a sense that I had an interest in, you know, creative expression. You know, I like painting. I also like writing. So there was a clear choice, you know, that presented itself between law and architecture. So I got into National Law School, Bangalore, India's best law school. And I also made it, I think, to the final round of interviews for INSEPT Ahmedabad, which is arguably India's number one architecture school. And I had to kind of pick between the two, you know, and, you know, I picked law. It was intuitive. I think my father also pushed me to, you know, saying that, look, it was better suited to your personality. And looking back, that's exactly right, because, you know, I enjoy doing creative things. But I enjoy also speaking and writing, and, you know, the law is much more suited to that. So I think that was the first kind of fork, and I could have got either way. I could have been an architect or a lawyer. You know, as it turned out, I'm neither, right? But what I'm doing is a little more suited to law and the skills required to be a lawyer than it is to be an architect. The second career of a fork was in 2007. So I'd done 5 years at National Law School, Bangalore. I'd got into Harvard Law School for a master's. You know, I was over the moon. And then the question was, what do I do after that? Do I be a corporate lawyer in the US? Am I back in India litigating? Or do I be an academic? So, you know, I was thinking through these choices. And I remember taking a class in corporate law by a guy called Guhan Subramaniam, who Indian origin guy, but basically American, who taught corporate law at Harvard Law School. And he had a joint appointment at Harvard Business School. And he was the best teacher that I can think of. You know, he'd spent some time at McKinsey. His courses were highly structured. You know, every minute it seemed was planned. And he was very, very good. And, I worked hard. And I think I got a B minus or a C plus or something like that. And I think it was a very clear symbol that, you know, if you're taught by the world's best teacher in a particular subject and you work hard and you do badly, then you should look for something else, right? So I think it was a very clear signal. I also was interested in writing at that time. So, you know, and I was interested in academia. I liked the idea of a university. So I was determined to do a PhD. And I was thinking of PhD in political science because I was more and more interested in politics and law rather than law itself. And I, you know, didn't apply immediately for a PhD because I felt I should have something approaching life experience. And working as a political journalist in Delhi with Indian Express seemed like a life experience that could complement a PhD in political science, right? I mean, in India, you can't work for parties in the same way. So this just seemed, and it also catered to my interest in writing. So I came back to India, I came back to Delhi and, you know, worked in journalism. And most people thought that I was ridiculous, right? But given that I already had a degree from Harvard Law School, you know, they didn't think I was crazy. They thought I was eccentric. And I think there's a big difference in the two, right? Like, you know, poor people are crazy, rich people are eccentric, right? So if you have options and you screw it up, people think you're eccentric. You know, if you have no options and you screw it up, they think you're crazy, right? And I wanted to spend only a year in Indian Express. I wanted to cover the 2009 elections, the one which UPA comes back to power. So I wanted some experience in covering campaigns and writing about them. And I did a lot of that. But I love my job too much, right? And so the third fork in my career came around 2010. When I was asking myself, you know, I like Delhi, I like reporting, you know, I clearly like this world of politics and, you know, the world of the public sphere. I wasn't getting paid much, but I liked it. So should I do that or should I go to Princeton where I had already got a seat for a PhD in political science? You know, and that was the third fork. I sort of thought about it and I just picked a PhD because on the assumption that I could always come back and pursue journalism. And on hindsight, I think it was one of the best decisions I made because it gave me a lot of skill sets like research, library to study documents that journalism doesn't give you. What journalism gives you is the ability to interview
the ability to write quickly, sticking to a deadline. Academics are terrible at that, right? So it was a very good compliment. And, you know, in my current job, the current book I'm working on, or the last book, this marriage of, I would say, law, journalism, and academia with all its rigors, I think has really helped me. So, you know, looking back, I would say, you know, in my limited life, these are the three forks.
Got it. And just back to the point of coming to Delhi and working as a journalist after a degree in Harvard Law School, I'm sure a lot of your classmates must have been pursuing a career where the compensation levels were a huge multiple.
Yeah.
Talk to us about what was easy or what was hard about that choice.
You know, so it's a good question, right? On hindsight, I should have been worried about this question. But I had enough of a sense of the kind of hours they put in, especially if you were a corporate lawyer in America, to realize that that kind of money came with a lot of physical, emotional stress. The fact that you may not be doing things that you are enjoying, you know. So an average corporate lawyer works on some cases and some clients that he or she loves. But, you know, if I would ask them, they would say that's 20% of the time, right? And I just didn't want a career where I'm being paid a lot, but I'm happy 20% of the time, you know. So I think that, so looking back again, you know, I had a sense of the kind of money you made if you were a corporate lawyer in New York. I also had a sense of the costs of that. And also, look, you know, from Harvard Law School, getting a corporate law job in New York is not, you know, it wasn't a walk-in for me. I would have had to put effort, you know, because this was just after the financial crisis. This was after Lehman. So it wasn't as easy as, you know, you think it is after a Harvard Law School degree. You know?
And Vinay, given the various things you've done so far, how do you think about your identity and how that's evolving?
Well, you know, I mean, I have a law degree. You know, I've been a journalist. I've been an academic. And you can be bad in all three, right? So that's been a bit of an, you know, a question. People said, academics think of you, you know, as a poor academic journalist, think, you know, so you're nowhere, you know. In India, you say, gali ka kutta na, na ghar ka na ghat ka. So it's a little bit like that. But I think the one thing I've learned is A, that, you know, focus on the product, not on the category. So like the question is not, are you a journalist? Are you an academic? But what is your output? If you're a journalist, you know, you can be somebody who writes books and articles that are so well researched and refer to existing scholarship in a way that is better than most academics, right? And as an academic, you can be somebody who actually gets on the ground, gets her or his legs dirty, you know, in a way that would put most journalists to shame. So rather than ask yourself which category you fit in, I think it's very important to realize what product you fit into, right? And the second thing I've learned from all these careers is that, you know, you would think that academics would talk about academic ideas all the time and lawyers would talk about legal rights. But actually, all of them are talking about the same thing, which is whose office is smaller, whose office is bigger, right? And a lot of the things that you associate with law, for example, legalese, right? Speaking in legal jargon, is actually to ensure that, you know, to create artificial value for a lawyer, right? You know, journalists write in a certain code, academics use jargon, because if they wrote in simple English, people would realize that often they don't have value. And so all different professions end up creating protocols that are not intrinsically adding value, but to exclude normal people and make them feel special, because that's why you'll pay them, right? Like if a lawyer, you know, wrote in simple English, then the client may be able to do that too. Then why do you need to pay a lawyer? So, I think one advantage I've had is I've been able to separate what I hope is a lot of bullshit associated with these professions to ask at its core, what value is it providing?
When I'm moving on, your PhD thesis was about getting to good judgments, right? And that's a topic that I'm quite curious about. When you, in your study of various judgments that have been made and the judges behind those judgments, talk to us about what stands out about them, about the judges, if there's an insight into the kind of people they were that helped them make good judgments, and about what we can learn in terms of how to get to meaningful judgments, especially in shades of gray.
So my PhD thesis topic was a marriage of my interest in law or my career or my academic career in law married with my work in journalism. Sure. Because I was a lawyer, my boss in Indian Express put me on to cover a lot of legal cases. And I was looking at a lot of these judgments, what people call path-breaking judgments after the judgments. You know, the title of the dissertation was After Judgment Day. And I remember one of the people I interviewed who was affected by a judgment telling me, and he said it in Hindi, so I'll say it in Hindi and then in English, ki hum jante hain ki kutta bhokta hai, but kya wo kaatta hai. You know, we know that the Supreme Court of India, you know, seems to bark, but does it bite? You know, does it have an impact? And that stayed with me, you know. And while I was a PhD student, I just kept pushing this idea. Let me pick a bunch of cases that everyone thinks were successful. And let me follow it 10 years from now. You know, let me follow it 15 years from then to see actually did the intended impact of the judge take place on the ground, right? And the answer was no, very often. And it was a pretty simple reason that, you know, that the judge simply didn't understand her or his ecosystem. That the same judgment implemented in, the same judgment pronounced by the top court in Switzerland, and the same judgment pronounced by the top court in India, and the same judgment pronounced by a top court in Somalia will have very different implementation effects. And the reason is that state capacity, the ability of the state to implement its will, varies vastly between Switzerland, America, India, and Somalia, right? And I was astounded that very few lawyers thought about it. And then I realized that lawyers only care about this and judges only care about this until they get the judgment. And then everybody makes money and everybody goes home, right? But there's a whole world of the effects of the judgment after that. So I think the first big lesson I learned about not just lawyers and judges, but also people who keep going to court for social causes, that, you know, maybe you're wasting your time, right? Maybe you don't understand the ecosystem in which you work, right? If you're not able to get things done outside the court, what makes you think you can get it done within the court when the same problems affecting implementation outside inhibit the court from actually being powerful within, right? So I think that was a very big lesson for me that, you know, if you're a leader, right, understand the power you have, right? Before making a judgment, before making a decision, first realize, do you actually have the power to enforce that or not? And if you don't, maybe you should tailor make the decision to not what is ideal, right? But which is actually implementable on the ground given the implementation capacity you have.
Got it. Got it. Very, very interesting. Let's move to Narasimha Rao. Talk to us about why you decided to write the book.
So that was, it wasn't thought through. You know, I knew nothing about him. Narasimha Rao, I never met Narasimha Rao. I'm not Telugu speaking, like I'm not from Andhra Pradesh or Telangana. I didn't know much about him before I decided to write a book on him. I wanted to write a book on India changing, on transitioning in the early 1990s, right? You know, I had personal experience. You know, my father moved from a government job, you know, to try to make it in the private sector. And I also, speaking to friends, I realized that the 90s was a period of transition. And as a journalist and academic, the data supported that, right? It's an inflection point when it comes to consumption of goods, when it comes to real incomes across percentiles. So my personal anecdote seemed to mirror a larger transition in India. And I had an instinct that the conventional explanations, namely that, you know, it just happened, or that Manmohan Singh, armed with a PhD, did it, right? Or India changed under pressure from the IMF, wasn't the complete story. But I didn't know anything more than that, and I didn't know much about Narasimha Rao, but I read this book, about maybe a year before I started working on the book, called Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China, by this Harvard historian called Ezra Vogel. And it was a biography of China changing in the 90s, superimposed with a biography of Deng Xiaoping, the political leader, the person who did it. And I said, immediately there's a book waiting to be written in India of India changing in the 90s and the political leader at the time, Narasimha Rao, right? And since I was a political scientist, I said, let me tell the political story. So again, I went with it completely neutrally. I didn't write a book to make Narasimha Rao look great. But while I was doing research, I realized that the character of Narasimha Rao was far more interesting than the limited story of liberalization in India. So the book then morphed into from what was initially seen as a book on liberalization, seen through the eyes of Narasimha Rao, to a full-length biography of Narasimha Rao, in which liberalization is just two chapters. So it kind of, you know, it's a very organic way in which, you know, I thought about something and then I just followed the evidence. You know?
Very interesting. Let's move to Narasimha Rao. I read the book and they were just so rich, and there's so much that the corporate world can learn. But the one thing that really struck me was just how he learned and grew as a leader, given where he came from. Talk to us about his learning approach over the years. And again, I'm also curious about how that evolved over time. I know I'm sort of asking a question which covers his life, but I'm curious about what was distinctive about Narasimha Rao and how he learned and how he thought about developing himself.
Well, I think there are three things that make Narasimha Rao stand out, you know, with regard to what you asked, and, you know, merging it together, that really helped his learning. One is, he was a man of unusually high IQ, right? And it's not really understandable through his social base, right?
You know, most of his, his family were, Brahmin landowners. They weren't very educated. Telangana being Telangana, they were not allowed, and they were in the Telangana region. They couldn't, get government service. So most of them were like landed gentry, right? And they didn't really read books. They didn't have that. So, his IQ levels were unusual by his social context, definitely. Second is he was an innately curious guy. And I think that's linked to his loneliness. You know, from a childhood, he's a lonely person, doesn't really identify with human beings, which is unusual for a politician. So instead, he's reading books. He's reading articles, right? He's reading poetry. He's writing. So that, I think that's a second part of him that adds to his learning. The third is that, he had unusual amounts of experience in India. From working in the panchayat level to working as a state minister, to working as chief minister, to working as union minister for nearly a decade, to then being prime minister, right? And holding a MLA position in Telangana, as well as an MP, member of parliament from three different states in India, where he campaigned in three different languages. The man had a very unique range of experiences. And I think that mix of being somebody who was curious, who had a high IQ, and who was just put in so many different public positions in India, gave him this enormous ability to learn and learn very quickly and learn in changing circumstances.
And a related question, Vinay, was the other thing that came through very clearly was the habit of reflection and introspection.
Yeah.
And I guess you allude to that in the context of accessing some of his diaries and his thoughts in the context of your research. But talk to us a little bit about his habit around reflection and introspection and what can we learn from it.
So I think one is what's the cause, and two is it helpful, right? I think the cause was, firstly, as I said, he was a lonely guy. So what does he do in the evenings, right? He keeps a diary. And he didn't have too many friends. So the diary, like, Anne Frank's diary was, fundamentally a diary that you're talking in the absence of a friend, right? But luckily for him, he was lonely from childhood. So then when he reaches the top in politics, when everybody is lonely, he's pretty used to it. So he's not worried at that point, right? Because he's prepared for loneliness all his life. But I think the diary was a way in which he could be true to himself, because a lot of politicians get fooled by, especially when they're in power, get fooled by the world around them, are unable to tell flattery from the truth. And Narasimha Rao's ability to be introspected, to be inward, helped him sift the day into what, or to put it in statistical terms, to be able to sift the signal from the noise. So I think that's the first thing that introspection taught him, that, one is it taught him don't trust anyone except your diary, which is a pretty good skill in politics. Second is that you should be able to sift the signal from the noise, Who are the people you met every day? How many people are being honest? How many people are lying? To give you just one example, one of the diary entries which I have in the book is from 22nd May 1991, right? This is the day after Rajiv Gandhi has been killed near Chennai. And Narasimha Rao, who until then had been basically eased out of the Congress and was about to become a monk in a monastery called Kottralam in Tamil Nadu and was closing his bank accounts, is suddenly realizing that by virtue of being the least ambitious man in the party, he's primed to be Prime Minister of India, right? And the diary shows, 22nd May, he's back in Delhi. He's in 10 Janpath, where Sonia Gandhi and Rajiv used to live. And, pieces of Rajiv Gandhi's body, they're just pieces, they're not the full body, are kept there. And all the congressmen are around the body pretending to cry, some of them actually crying, while actually trying to maneuver to see who would succeed him. And he has this wonderful passage about how Pranab Mukherjee, who was in the boondocks then, but would later recover to become President of India, wheedles up to him and says, "We think you should become Prime Minister, Congress President," which is the proxy for Prime Minister of India. And Narasimha Rao immediately says, "I immediately told him that, that it was, that I'm not the right person," right? Knowing full well the kind of person he is. "I also gave him the name of N.D. Tiwari for Prime Minister of India, knowing that he was even less likely a candidate than I am," right? And I think the introspection and the diary allows him to do that. It allows him to reflect over the day. Otherwise, think of it. Somebody else come, Pranab Mukherjee came up to me and says, "Maybe you should be Prime Minister of India." I won't stop to ask what's his angle, right? So I think the introspection gave him that ability. I think the third thing introspection gave him was to take the long view. Often we're so caught up in the moment that we're unable to, to see short-term benefit from long-term, long-term costs. We're unable to separate that, right? For example, Narasimha Rao was frequently sidelined from the party. Frequently. He never complained. He never protested against Indira Gandhi. He never protested against Rajiv Gandhi. And very soon he would be back. Whereas people like Sharad Pawar, right? Arjun Singh, right? Or N.D. Tiwari,
at the first sign that they were out of favor in the Nehru-Gandhi court, would either form a separate party or sulk or protest. And their careers would end, you know, instead of just kind of, you know, taking it and, you know, hoping that your luck changes, which happened to Narasimha Rao. Now, look, not everybody's luck changes, right? But I think Narasimha Rao's ability to take the long view and not make silly short-term beneficial decisions also contributed to the kind of career he had.
Got it. And just picking up on one of the pieces, Vinay, decoding the signal from the noise, you know, one would think that, you know, there's a benefit in having networks and people telling you, you know, what makes sense and you sort of making sense of that. It's very interesting that he's sort of decoding the signal from the noise in a lonely fashion. How do you think about that? Because how do you decipher intent in a lonely fashion? Wouldn't you, common sense would suggest that you need to have your agents out there come and give you information for you to make sense. So how do you reconcile the two?
No, that's a very good question. And, you know, I did think about this quite a bit, right? And I think the key to the answer is to look at the ecosystem that Narasimha Rao worked under. Now, all of us work under different organizational forms, right?
Right.
In some organizations, it's important to have your tentacles everywhere, right?
Yeah.
But in a organization like the Congress Party, especially in the 70s, 80s, loneliness was an enormous political virtue. Because if you didn't have too many friends, it meant you didn't have too many enemies. The way the Congress system worked, and this is a famous political scientist, Rajni Kothari's phrase, was that especially in the 50s and 60s, when there was no opposition to the Congress, all the factions of India, you know, the Dalits or Brahmins, left wing or right wing, right, south of India, north of India, was within the Congress party. So you'd have a Congress politician who was Dalit, like Jagjivan Ram. You'd have a Brahmin politician like N.D. Tiwari, right? You'll have a North Indian politician, you'll have a South Indian politician. You'll have a capitalist politician, you'll have a socialist politician, right? And even at the state levels, you'd have factions, which are not really based on ideology. So you'll have in Maharashtra alone, if you look at the Congress, you'll have an Ashok Chauhan faction. You'll have a Prithviraj Chauhan faction, right? And earlier you had a Sharad Pawar's Suresh Kalmadi faction. Now, in that, and the beauty of that system is it suits the high command very well because everybody is cutting each other. So nobody is threatening Sonia Gandhi, nobody is threatening Rajiv Gandhi because at the state level, everybody is cutting each other. Now, given that this is the dynamic of the Congress party, you should not be associated with the faction because the moment you associate with a faction, by nature, you have some friends, but you have a lot of enemies. And in typically what happens in faction struggles is that, you know, and this is what happened with Narasimha Rao when he became the unlikely chief minister of Andhra Pradesh in 1971, that there were these two very big factions, both very powerful. And each one said, we don't want the other guy to be chief minister. And so there was a compromise candidate, a person who was weak, who had no friends, who was lonely, who didn't threaten everyone. And that man was Narasimha Rao. Why was Narasimha Rao made prime minister in 1991? Because for Sonia Gandhi and the people around her, the other far more obvious candidates, Sharad Pawar, N.D. Tiwari, Arjun Singh, were also powerful, were also people with friends. You know, so the ecosystem of Narasimha Rao was such that loneliness was a virtue. But if loneliness is a virtue, then how the hell do you get information? And you get information through introspection, not by having tentacles within the party. But to be fair, Narasimha Rao had a lot of tentacles outside the party. So he had people like Chandraswamy, Tantrics, opposition member, telling him about the Congress, because within his own party, he just couldn't trust anyone. You know, so I think the answer here is that, you know, your levels of introspection, you have to keep in mind the organizational ecosystem you work under. And it varies from, you know, and even within the Indian party system, the Congress organizational structure is very unique. And it comes from a history of being the only political party in India. And therefore, the opposition parties are actually within the party itself, right? And in such a situation, you have to be Narasimha Rao to rise.
Very, very interesting. Very nuanced and insightful. And just sticking to the theme of introspection, is there anything to be said about the nature of introspection or the nature of note-keeping? Was it a certain pattern or discipline or a certain heads under which he would capture his thoughts, or was it free-flowing?
I'm just inducting based on what archives I saw. But he kept diaries better when he was out of power. Once you're in power, you're just much busier, right? But there were frequent periods in the Congress party when he was out of power, when he was hanging around. So there the diaries are pretty strong. Now, this is bad for a biographer because you actually want to know a little more about what he's doing when he is in power, right? Sure. So for that, I used the appointment diary, you know, because I knew who he was meeting for every 15 minutes. So I didn't know what they were talking about, but I had a sense of the world of people he was meeting with. But his own diaries are kind of less detailed and less gossipy, certainly, when he's in power.
And the other thing I'm curious about is how leaders spend time, what their pie chart of time looks like. When you analyze his diaries, appointment diaries, when he was in power, and if you had to draw a pie chart, would you have a sense of what the big segments are in terms of how he would spend time?
Well, I mean, I can give you a, you know, morning, you know, from morning upma to night ragi story. But I don't think that's what you care about.
Right. But just so what are the big themes, you know, as a leader, what are the kind of themes that take up time, where he would prioritize?
Well, so I think for politicians, you have to put them in three categories when it comes to time. First is during election campaign. Election campaign is really the moments that galvanize parties, money pours in. You know, if you go to any party office, and there's no elections, right? The party office is dead, you know. In fact, I once visited a party office in a district I don't want to name, when between elections, they would basically make it into a sabzi mandi. So they could get rent out of the office because no activity takes place around elections. So when around elections, politicians are very different. And that's when they really come to them. The mass politicians really come to themselves. They're traveling intensively. They're meeting hundreds of people. Money is pouring in. So I think that's one phase, right? Phase two is when they're in government. You know, and that is it's a routine which, you know, moves between. So when they're in government, they're typically not spending any time in their constituency. But the time in government moves between constantly dealing with files, like files and signing files and files moving up and moving down. You know, it's a daily job of politicians, right? And between meeting people, you're constantly meeting people, right? And a lot of times meeting a minister and meeting a prime minister is an end in itself. So you'll have like, you know, the, you know, secretary to the Dalai Lama coming and wasting your time for an hour. And you have to do it, right? And if it's less important, you can fob it off to a junior minister. But otherwise, you have to do it, right? So in many ways, the Prime Minister of India is not just an executive head, is also a titular head. So there's no shortage of people, you know, the Independence Day, you know, martyrs of Indian Independence Association will call you for lunch. You got to show up there. If you don't, it'll be taken as a slight. So I think that's two, right? But the main thing a politician in government does is firefighting. You know, and the contrary to this view that the government of India or any government functions perfectly, you're there and every morning you wake up reading the newspaper, typically that's where you get your information and there's a new crisis. And you've got to figure out how to react to it. So I think a key, especially in the Indian government, the state capacity being what it is you're frequently dealing with problems not of your making, which no one has warned you about, and you've got to react very quickly, right? So I think that's broadly what the day looks like if you're in power. And when you're in opposition, you actually have a ton of time. You know, so some politicians take to painting, you know, others take to, you know, hanging around, making your way through the opposition party. So that I think that when you're in opposition, it's a different game. Narasimha Rao luckily had a ton of hobbies, you know, and he knew how to paint, he knew how to write, he was constantly learning languages. So he wasn't making foolish mistakes when in opposition. To give you an example, arguably the greatest politician Maharashtra has produced is a guy called Y.B. Chavan, right? Who could have, in a non-dynastic party, could have been Prime Minister of India. Again, I may have got the facts wrong, so you should just check that. But in 1977, when Indira Gandhi loses very badly and the Janata government comes to power, if my memory serves, Y.B. Chavan makes the mistake of rebelling. It's a problem because Indira Gandhi is back 3 years later and Y.B. Chavan is now a rebellious man. Narasimha Rao could have also rebelled, you know, because everyone at that time was writing Indira Gandhi's political obituary. What does he do? He drives his own car to Jawaharlal Nehru University, enrolls in the Spanish languages department and learns Spanish, right? So, you know, often politics, because it's a marathon race, not a sprint, you have to realize in the lean periods that you shouldn't make stupid decisions, right? And the fact that Narasimha Rao had interests outside of politics meant that he wasn't morning to evening asking himself, how do I get to power? And that prevented him from making short-term beneficial decisions that would prove catastrophic in the long term.
And was there a certain theme to the curiosity or was it just unfettered curiosity?
No, I think it was unfettered. You know, I mean, I have so many stories there that, you know, he sees a motor pump, you know, and he wants to figure out how it works, right? The then head of the nuclear program, the man who appointed Abdul Kalam, a guy called V.S. Arunachalam, went to meet Narasimha Rao when he became Prime Minister to talk about the nuclear program. Narasimha Rao wanted a drawing about, you know, where the, you know, what the bomb looks like, you know, where is the uranium kept, you know, just a simple map. So I think he fundamentally wanted to figure out how things worked. And that's very, and that coupled with the fact that he didn't have a narrow experience. He had such a wide range. You know, he was defense minister, he was education minister, he was foreign minister, you know, he was Hindu endowment minister, you know, in charge of temples in Andhra Pradesh. He was chief minister, he was prime minister, you know, gave him a really, really unique sense of how to apply your curiosity to very different fields. And I think there's a lesson there for people outside politics that if you want to rise to the top, know how different parts of your organization work. Or you should have at least a working knowledge, right? So if you're a CA by training, you shouldn't only have a finance sense of the organization, even if that's your core competency. You should have some sense about how different parts of your organization work. Because at the very top, you need to have some sense of that, you know.
And the other theme that came through very clearly in what you said, and even in the book, Vinay, is resilience. And you spoke about Narasimha Rao almost becoming a monk.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, you know, sort of making himself available for the biggest post in the country.
Yeah.
So talk to us about where he got the strength. You know, what made him resilient?
So it's hard to say, you know, because... So I can talk about his, you know, his family and his growing up, but there's a part of a human being that, you know, 2 + 2 in human beings is not always 4, right? So, you know, think of your best friend or somebody you know very well. You think you know them very well and you think you've understood the components that made the person, but then they surprise you, right? So Narasimha Rao had, you know, it's hard to tell where he got this from, right? So, I mean, to give you another example of his resilience or shall I say his ability to surprise me was that he was a lifelong economic protectionist, right? Lifelong, right? So one thing he didn't know much about, and he was a protectionist. He didn't believe in opening the economy, right? He was very suspicious of capitalists. But when he becomes prime minister in June 91, and he realizes the scale of the economic crisis, within 2 or 3 days, he has changed his mind 180 degrees, right? That's remarkable, you know? And it's not something I tried very hard to find out, you know, is it because his father treated him some way? Is it because he was served dinner? And I think that's useful as a biographer in trying to understand human beings. But sometimes human beings surprise you. And that, his resilience, his slight tangent to power, it's not easy to explain, you know. Is his innate curiosity? Is it the fact that he also saw himself as a scholar? Or is it, which I believe the most likely explanation, he has interests other than power? He liked to paint. He liked to learn languages, right? You know, towards the end of his life, he wanted to ward off arthritis to his hands. So he learned to play the piano, right? And so he found meaning in things other than the immediate interest in power. And I think that is partly what gave him this tangential view of power, that I think greatly contributed to his understanding of it. You know, so to use the old Zen phrase, you know, he was in this world but not of it. So Narasimha Rao was in politics, but he was not of it.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. If you're deriving value from this conversation, you might find our curated library interesting. You will find this in the members section at playtopotential.com. It has more than 1,000 short-form content pieces that we've painstakingly organized and tagged by themes and made it searchable through a simple Google search type interface. In the archives, we break down each conversation into 10 or so nuggets of about 5 to 10 minutes each. On top of that, I often share my perspectives on what's being said and often cross-link it to another piece of wisdom from the podcast archives. We believe that most of the content world over is organized as multiple insights from one speaker. In our library, we flip this idea on its head and you have the opportunity to listen to multiple perspectives on a topic you're curious about. This includes topics like mindfulness, habits, journaling, reinventing ourselves, parenting, influencing, judgment, and 60-odd themes. In a world of abundant content, we believe there is value in contextual content and diversity of thought on each topic. In our podcast, we've spoken to Olympic medalists, Thinkers 50 listers, Ivy League professors, notable CEOs and entrepreneurs, leading coaches, and many more voices. Please head to www.playtopotential.com to know more about the Play to Potential membership. I repeat, it is playtopotential.com. Let's now get back to the podcast episode.
When you speak about how he quickly changed his opinion, I'm curious about the notion of intellectual agility. You know, how leaders have strong views, but when they see data saying something else, they're very quickly, they're able to shift their beliefs. So talk to us about what gave that agility to Narasimha Rao.
Well, firstly, there are plenty of examples of this. The most famous one is his views on economic reforms. It was one of the few posts he hadn't held. You know, he'd never been industry minister before he became prime minister. He'd never been minister of finance. That was one area he didn't know very well. To the extent he knew it, he was an Indira Gandhi-style protectionist. You know, and, you know, when confronted with a change in evidence, you know, when confronted with the fact that, you know, the Indian economy was simply not working, we had a balance of payment crisis, when he became prime minister in June 91, he changes his mind in a couple of days. And what is remarkable is once he changes his mind, he has this ability to execute, right? To implement. I mean, in India is full of ideas. You know, Narasimha Rao's remarkable ability is, and this is underrated because when people think of him as intellectually agile, as being a scholar, they forget the fact that he was tactically agile too. He knew how to get things done, right? He would have an idea, he would have a view, but he also knew the art of the possible. And I think that this agility, both these were a kind of jugalbandi. They worked hand in hand. That he could change his mind when it came to ideas. And he could also constantly refine implementation of those ideas, right? Let's take, you know, the classic example of Air India, right? Initially, he believed that Air India, that airline sector in India should be a national sector. You should not allow private competition and you should certainly not allow foreign money. But, you know, he changes his mind in the early 90s and he realizes that, you know, look, we need private competition when it came to airlines. Indian airlines alone just won't do. Right. So he definitely had the ability when faced with data to change his mind. He also had the intellect, the agility when it came to implementation, which is what I call fox, mouse and lion. Right. He realized that you needed private competition. So he allowed Jet Airways, Damania, East West Airlines. Jet Airways, I think, takes off in 93. And today, again, you know, correct me on the data, but, you know, 80 to 90% of domestic travelers don't travel on Indian Air India. They travel on on Indigo, on Go Airways. So Narasimha Rao's bet worked, right? At the same time, Narasimha Rao had the intellect or the, let's say, the implementation agility to realize that, you know, if he went too far and he privatized Air India at that time, the unions would protest hugely and his entire liberalization agenda would fall because he was a very weak prime minister. So he publicly swore that not a single Indian Airlines or Air India employee would lose his or her job as a result of privatization. That's exactly what he did. Right? So the unions were happy because they weren't getting fired. He created things like VRS, but the unions were happy as well as the consumers were happy. But Narasimha Rao was smart enough to realize that you can't keep hiring in Air India and Indian Airlines if it isn't making profit. So if you just look at the data, hiring into Indian Airlines and Air India and other PSUs begins to freeze after Narasimha Rao comes to power. Because Narasimha Rao realizes that those who haven't yet got jobs aren't going to protest against him. So I think that there was an intellectual agility of the man, his ability to frequently change his mind when confronted with data. There was also an implementational agility. And Narasimha Rao's genius was both ideas and implementation came naturally to him. And that's what makes him really rare.
Very interesting. And I want to pick up on the three sort of animals used to sort of make the point, lion, fox, mouse. So let's double click on that. Talk to us about what you have in mind when you say that. But more importantly, how does Narasimha Rao exercise his judgment to figure out what to be when?
That's very hard to answer, right? That when do you know, you know, I mean, ask yourself this question, right? Like, you know, anyone listening to this podcast would frequently be in situations where you have to play lion, right? You have to be aggressive and you have to play to win, right? You know, slightly smarter ones who are listening to this podcast would also know that, you know, sometimes you have to lose. You know, sometimes, you know, the American phrase, right? Do I want to die on this hill? Like, some battles are not worth fighting because you may win the battle, you may lose the war, right? And sometimes you have to lie, you have to cheat, right? You can't say what you want to say. Narasimha Rao's ability was to get both timing and circumstance very, very right, you know, and it's very hard to push that into a set of transferable skills because, you know, that's why judgment is so precious. But to give you just one example of that, India opening up to Israel, right? Just one example of that. Now, since the mid-80s, it was pretty clear that India had to move away from the Soviet Union towards the United States. It was clear that the Soviet model of the economy was not really working. Rajiv Gandhi was trying to, make an outreach towards Washington, D.C. It didn't really go the way he wanted to go. When Narasimha Rao becomes prime minister, he is told that, look, you know, the Berlin Wall has fallen. America is a lone superpower and we were on the wrong side of the Cold War. So we have to make an overture to Washington, D.C., right? And Narasimha Rao is also told by his IFS officers, his diplomat, that the road to Washington, D.C. runs through Tel Aviv. That India currently doesn't have diplomatic relations with Israel for a variety of reasons. We need to have diplomatic relations with Israel as a signal to America that now we are with America. Now, this was a domestic political hot potato, right? Because there was a feeling in India that Muslims might object. There was a feeling in India that, you know, for most of India's independence, we had supported the Palestinian cause. So it was a sensitive issue, opening up to Israel, having full ambassadorial relations. What does Narasimha Rao do? He invites in Jan 92, Yasser Arafat, the head of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, as chief guest to India. He hugs him. He tells his cabinet secretary, Naresh Chandra, to spread that photograph. The message is India is not deserting its Palestinian allies. In private, however, Narasimha Rao tells Yasser Arafat that, look, you are talking to the Israelis, what would ultimately culminate in the Oslo Accords of 93. If you want us to lobby the Israelis on your behalf, we have to have an ambassador. And Yasser Arafat, who's as much wily as Narasimha Rao, publicly states in Delhi that exchange of ambassadors is a sovereign question and we won't interfere with what our brother India does. Narasimha Rao immediately announces full diplomatic relations with Israel, goes to parliament and says publicly, with the blessings of my brother Yasser Arafat, I'm sending an ambassador to Israel, right? That is timing, right? It's understanding political context, understanding the different stakeholders, right? And getting the sequence exactly right. And contrast that to someone like Rajiv Gandhi, who came to power in 1984-85 with the largest mandate any prime minister has got in India. He actually tried in 85-86 to open up to Israel and he failed. So just power alone, just mandate alone is insufficient if you don't understand timing, if you don't understand your opponents. And that was Narasimha Rao's genius.
So just picking up on that, Vinay, one of the themes that comes through very clearly in the book as a attribute of Narasimha Rao is driving change under extreme constraints. Two terms before and four terms after him lasted less than a year. So it's fascinating that he was able to last a full term, but much more than that, was able to push through path-breaking reforms. So again, as we think about him being able to drive change under these constraints, are there themes that come out which are worth talking about in terms of what he did well to manage the sort of the slender context with the heaviness of the stuff that he was pushing through?
Well, this is the heart of the book, right? The central question of the book is, how did a man so weak achieve so much change? So it's not just that he was running a minority government. His own party hated him. He had to report to Sonia Gandhi, right? And the crisis that India had, from secession issues in Assam, Punjab and Kashmir, to our balance of payment crisis, to the fall of the Soviet Union, to Rajiv Gandhi's assassination. So here's a man with very little power, and Narasimha Rao also was, had famously the charisma of a dead fish. He was a really boring guy. So a man with very little charisma, right? Very little raw political power, very little mandate, and facing an inbox from hell, made this kind of change, right? And that's really the heart of the book. And I push at it again and again. I think one, and I could give many examples of it, but I think a core feature of why Narasimha Rao was successful was that instead of focusing on what needed to be done, he focused on how it should be done. And I think that's very important. That the what question, what needs to be done, presumes you have a mandate, presumes you have the ability to get things done. The first question you should ask as a leader is, where do you get your power from? How much power do you have? If you want to do X, can you do X, right? Or can you do only X minus 1? In which case you should ab initio begin by trying to do X minus 1 because that's the maximum you can do. I think that was Narasimha Rao's genius, that he had no illusions that he was a weak prime minister. He wasn't easily flattered by, the normal chamchas around you who make all politicians think they're Alexander the Great. He knew he was not charismatic. He knew people didn't like him. He knew he was a fill-in for the Nehru Gandhis because Rajiv had died. And he relentlessly focused on how you should get things done, right? Second is he had this ability to play one constraint against the other. So he had a lot of people who didn't like him. So he spent a lot of time making sure that those who didn't like him were busy fighting each other, right? To give one classic example, the two main opposition parties he had to deal with were the left and the BJP, right? And he just, you know, and if the two of them had voted together in any no-confidence motion, Narasimha Rao would have been toast. He would have to resign immediately. So Narasimha Rao spent a lot of energy making sure that these two constraints, the BJP and the communists, were always fighting with each other, right? So, for example, he would, go and tell, when the communists would come in to him and complain about liberalization, one communist MP told me this, Narasimha Rao said, forget about liberalization, think of Babri Masjid. It's communalism that is the problem today. We need to focus on secularism, and on this, you have to be on my side. He does this instinctively, it's remarkable, right?
It's the fox, right?
It's the fox, 100%, right? And think about what that achieves, right? Immediately after the demolition of Babri Masjid, when everyone is baying for Narasimha Rao's blood, where everybody on India thinks that his political career has ended, what does he do? He opens private licenses for banks, right? That's what he does soon after Babri Masjid, right? Now, in India, giving private licenses for new banks is a highly political subject, right? Remember that Indira Gandhi's nationalization, the famous socialist phase, began with the nationalization of private banks, right? It was nationalized once in the late 1960s and a second time in 1980. So giving banks licenses to new banks, which are today very famous, ICICI, HDFC, for example, is a politically loaded subject. So when does Narasimha Rao pick the time to do it? Immediately after demolition of Babri Masjid, when the communists, when the socialists within his own party are rallying around him against the onslaught of the communal BJP, right? That's Narasimha Rao's ability to play constraint against each other, but at the same time being deeply aware of the fact that it's very important to focus on how to do things in India, not what to do.
Very, very interesting. And the other theme I wanted to pick up on when I was how leaders transition into a new context. Right, it's quite relevant when they move organizations or change careers. Here, actually, when we think about how Rao had to recalibrate his approach at various points, especially when he moves from the Indira Gandhi era to the Rajiv Gandhi era, talk to us a little bit about how Rao reinvented himself as he moved from one to the other.
No, I think it was his great skill. I mean, let's begin with the first big transition. When he moves as a freedom fighter, he begins his career as a freedom fighter, which in Telangana meant being both anti-British as well as anti-Nizam, right? And he moves from that to being a Congress politician, right? And he immediately moves from being somebody who's a freedom fighter to a socialist, a Nehruvian socialist, who believes in the power of the state, right? He is a socialist. He understands how to play the factions, that there are these different Congress factions that, it's not that, India was given freedom by this united group and they remain united. Because the moment the British leave, the Congress party begins to fight with each other, and he gets that very well. So I think he understands that is his first transition, and he does it very well. The second big transition is, which he fails, is when he becomes chief minister. Now, he thinks he's being rewarded by Indira Gandhi because, he's a socialist, he's going to be a socialist, he's going to bring about land reforms. He doesn't realize that he's been made chief minister because he's a puppet, because he doesn't have power, right? Because he's not going to threaten Indira Gandhi. And he pushes radical land reforms. There's a pushback. Indira Gandhi feels threatened and sacks him. So I think that's a transition he gets wrong. Luckily for him, he has the ability to introspect and learn from that failed transition, that he had to move from being a socialist politician to a supplicant of Indira Gandhi, right? He fails to understand that. And then he's soon back, and for a decade and a half, he's a supplicant to the Nehru Gandhis. First Indira Gandhi and then Rajiv Gandhi. And he makes that transition very smoothly. Whereas people like Pranab Mukherjee and P.C. Alexander were very close to Indira Gandhi, simply failed to be that close to Rajiv Gandhi. Narasimha Rao was able to do that, right? And then his final transition, which is that from being a Nehru Gandhi supplicant, he is made Prime Minister of India. He really comes to his own, right? He really becomes his own man. Right? He really stops responding to Sonia Gandhi, stops listening to her. That's why they don't like each other. So I think his ability to understand political context was phenomenal. Many of his transitions was accurate. He understands when he's moving from one ecosystem to the other. Where he failed to understand it in 1973, for example, which is why he was sacked as Chief Minister of Andhra Pradesh, he has the ability to introspect on it, to create a new avatar, and then he's back in business.
And talking about new avatar, you also allude to the cultural shift, especially when we're talking about the Rajiv Gandhi era, the Oxbridge kind of culture that sort of existed in the core group.
Yeah.
And Narasimha Rao, given his background from Andhra Pradesh, Yeah. Charisma of a gold, dead fish rather. Talk to us about how he was able to fit into different cultures.
No, there's a very good story I have in the book on exactly this, which is that the Rajiv Gandhi era, you know, he was called Mr. Clean, you know, Indians loved him. They actually thought he was a break from his mother. So he surrounds himself with people who are educated, quote unquote, you know, in the modern sense. They've gone to Doon School, they've gone to Oxford, they've gone to Cambridge. They have private sector experience, people like, you know, Arun Nehru or Arun Singh, people who are his school buddies like Manishankar Iyer, his pilot friends, like Satish Sharma. These are people who are far removed from the kind of vernacular, derogatory in India we describe as Hindi-speaking type, world of Narasimha Rao, as far as can be. Narasimha Rao wears a dhoti, English is the fifth language he's learnt. You know, he likes, when he's doing nothing, he'll cross his legs and he'll massage his toes, right, in public. Now, these are things that, happens in a village, they don't happen in Doon School or Oxbridge, right? Narasimha Rao is also 65 in 1985, and Rajiv Gandhi is looking for younger people, and older people close to mummy are on their way out. And Narasimha Rao, at this point, he's defense minister, but he realizes his time is up. He overhears Rajiv Gandhi telling a friend of his that we need to remove import restrictions on computer peripherals, but the old fogies in my cabinet won't understand. And to give you some context, the personal computer revolution has come to the United States only in the late 1970s. And this is 1985. This is a 65-year-old dhoti-clad man, and this is India. The next day, after Narasimha Rao hears Rajiv Gandhi telling a friend of this, about old fogies not understanding, Narasimha Rao calls up his son in Hyderabad and said, "What is this computer? Please send me a sample." So next day, Indian Airlines flight from Hyderabad, a computer sent to his house in 9 Motilal Nehru Mark. Narasimha Rao goes to Darya Ganj in Old Delhi to get books on computer peripherals. He hires a master to teach him. And within that year and the next, he learns COBOL Basic, 2 computer languages, and can code in the operating system Unix, right? Wow. It's remarkable. I mean, just imagine a 65-year-old man doing that today, right?
Unbelievable.
And it's a perfect example of his curiosity and his political survival skills just coming together. And not only does he learn computers, he then becomes very close to Rajiv Gandhi, as close to Rajiv Gandhi as he was to Indira, right? He becomes foreign minister again. He is the first HRD minister, the education minister of India. And he's very close to Rajiv Gandhi. And don't forget, it's Rajiv Gandhi's widow, Sonia, who appoints him prime minister of India, right? He gets that close. So I think that, it tells you something about a man who understands transitions and understands the context behind transitions.
And is there anything to be said about the kind of portfolios he picks up? And we speak about the various things he's done and his sort of the political resume. But is there anything to be said about the way in which he's made choices to sort of garner those experiences?
Well, left to himself, the portfolios he liked best were welfare portfolios, health, education. He was very good about it. He cared about it. He was health and education minister in Andhra Pradesh. He was health and education minister in Delhi in the union government, right? He really had a feel for it. He understood and ideologically believed that the state had a role when it came to education. The state had a role when it came to health. Many of the big schemes that we today associate with, Manmohan Singh and Sonia Gandhi, like right to education, NREJ, the right to work, the first such central schemes happened during Narasimha Rao's time, which is why, a lot of this, argument that, 1991 with neoliberalism, the state receded is not true. That, Indian economy opening up was precisely the same time when Indian welfare schemes were opening up. And for the pretty simple causal explanation that you can't have good welfare schemes unless the government generates revenue. And while Indira Gandhi is called a socialist prime minister, she didn't have a central education scheme. She didn't have a central health scheme. It was socialism of rhetoric. Socialist countries are those that spend on education and health for its people. And that takes place in India after quote-unquote neoliberalism, right? So left to himself, I think he would have liked the welfare portfolio. But because he was the Mr. Indispensable, he ended up holding a very wide range of portfolios. Like I said, Hindu endowment. Law minister in Andhra Pradesh, right? In Delhi itself, he was foreign minister twice. He was home minister. He was defense minister, as you know, in India, you're not given portfolios because you're an expert. You're given portfolios because it signals your status in the pecking order, right? So I think that left to himself, he would have been a welfare, that was where, his heart lay. But, you know, because he was also a politician, you know, he liked the fact that, you know, he could pick more important ministries.
Got it. I want to talk about how Narasimha Rao picked his teams.
Yeah.
And again, clearly you spend a lot of time in the book talking about the diversity of people that he had on his team.
Yeah.
So talk to us a little bit about how Rao mastered sort of this notion of getting the right team to work with him.
Well, I think the first most important quality that Narasimha Rao brought to team building and team choosing was he was personally not an insecure person. That's really, really important. Now, there's a law in India, I think Arun Shori told me it was called the Indresan Law, named after this IIT professor, saying that in India, first-rate people hire first-rate people, second-rate people hire third-rate people, right, and so on. Because second-rate people are also insecure about their abilities. So they don't want to hire someone who is first-rate, right? And then in India, over time, you end up with ninth-rate people, right? So that's how, you know, institutional mediocrity takes place in India. Narasimha Rao was a first-rate guy, right? So when it came to, for example, foreign policy, he knew it really well. You know, he had academic friends in New York University who would send him the latest edition of top academic articles, right? He knew the history of China. He spoke Spanish. He knew Persian, he knew Urdu, and he was the rank one in Persian and Urdu in Nizam State, in Nizam's Hyderabad. And he could talk to the Pakistani president in Urdu. And most Pakistanis said that Narasimha Rao Urdu was better. You know, so he was extremely confident. So he was not insecure in selecting diplomats who were very good, right? He also was confident enough that when he didn't know something, he didn't pretend to know it. He knew nothing about economics. He had an instinct, but he didn't know anything about economics. So he had the confidence to first ask for the hiring of I.G. Patel, former RBI governor who was at the time London School of Economics head. I.G. Patel says no, arguably the most famous no in Indian history, saying that, look, I have a mother in Baroda, you know, she's old, I have to take care of her. So then he asks P.C. Alexander, who should I select? And P.C. Alexander said, look, there's this guy called Manmohan Singh, right? And, you know, he says that, fine, you know, get Manmohan Singh, you know, he seems to me the man who has the ideas that will get us out of this hole. He didn't know anything about economics, right? Manmohan Singh didn't know that. And he was not insecure that Manmohan Singh knew more economics than he did, right? He constantly consulted R. Venkatraman, who was the president at the time, a former finance minister, saying that, look, help me out, you know? And he understood very clearly that, look, the ideas that Manmohan Singh, I.G. Patel are talking about are ideas that we need to implement in India. But those ideas have been going around in India for decades. My job is to get it politically off the ground. He understood that very clearly. So I think that the core ability to not be insecure meant that he could hire first-rate talent around him, right? He had no problem with people walking into an office and saying, you know, Mr. Rao, I completely disagree with you. Because he was confident, right? He was not only a scholar, you know, if a district magistrate called him up and told him something, he could tell a district magistrate what to do because he knew districts better than district magistrate very often, right? So he was not afraid of talent. I think that is very important. In the Indian context, it's very rare. Very, very rare. Second is he had no personal friends. You know, as I told you, he was not a faction leader. Dr. Manmohan Singh, who I interviewed for this book, likes Narasimha Rao, but he wasn't a crony of Narasimha Rao at all. Right? He didn't know Narasimha Rao very well before he became prime minister. So second quality, Narasimha Rao was not looking for chamchas. He was not looking for yes men. He was not looking for people who would enhance his power. Right? He was looking for people who would get the job done. I think that's the second very, very rare quality, especially in the Indian context. Third is Narasimha Rao had this, you can call it ancient Indian philosophy, Hindu philosophy, you can call it what you want, that all parts have to be represented, right? That change and continuity are two sides of the same coin. That, you know, yes, capitalism is good, but you know what? Socialism is good too, right? So it's like, it's a classic Indian trait, right? Philosophically you call it the trait of a Guju Thali, right? Everything is there. So Narasimha Rao's cabinet was a little like a Gujarati Thali. There was a little bit of sweet, there was a little bit of sour, there was a little bit of papad, there was everything, right? So in his economic ministries, he had people like Manmohan Singh, Montek Singh Ahluwalia, who are quote-unquote free marketeers and right-wing, but running his welfare schemes were socialists like K.R. Venugopal and B.N. Yugandhar, incidentally the father and father-in-law of Satya Nadala, who runs Microsoft. So he had leftists, he had right-wing people, you know, he got along very well with scheduled castes, he got along very well with Brahmins, you know. He would speak to Sharad Pawar in Marathi, You know, he would speak to S.B. Chavan in Marathi and Telugu. You know, he would speak to someone else in clipped English. You know, he would speak to Salman Haider, his foreign secretary for a while, in clipped Urdu. And Salman Haider told me that, you know, his Urdu was the kind of Urdu spoken in those, you know, aristocratic Muslim households in Uttar Pradesh, right?
Wow.
So that was his ability to build teams, that he, you know, he realized that you need all kinds make a team. He wasn't looking for yes men at all. And he was confident enough in his own ability that he was never insecure when a team member outshone him or knew more about a particular subject than he did. And I think that is very, very rare.
And just maybe building on that, when I look at leadership in organizations in the corporate world, you often have people reporting to you who know much more about that topic or function than you do.
Yeah.
So in those situations, when it comes to decision making,
yeah,
where you're not as informed as the person reporting to you, yeah, how did Narasimha Rao make key decisions?
Well, that's really interesting.
Does he delegate it completely? What's the mechanism to make good decisions there?
So I think, well, I'll give you Narasimha Rao's view, which is that he trusted people around him, right? But he also realized that the expert knows only one thing. But a problem may have multiple components. You know, Manmohan Singh understands, you know, tariff reductions very well. Manmohan Singh doesn't know how to get it through the Lok Sabha. Manmohan Singh doesn't know how to get it through the Rajya Sabha, right? The you know, an IFS officer, a diplomat will tell you that, look, we need to make overtures to Israel, right? The diplomat doesn't know that you need the political signaling of hugging Yasser Arafat, right? So I think Nasimha's remarkable ability was that he relied on experts, right? But he knew that he alone had the 360 degree view.
And the how part, as you said.
And the how part, right? And the how part requires a 360 degree view, you know? In fact, I don't know whether this is relevant to this conversation, but, you know, my former boss, Shekhar Gupta, would always tell me that, you know, the difference between Indian leadership and Pakistani leadership is that democratic politicians are forced to take the 360 degree view. Whereas Pakistani, you know, leaders, typically dictators, military dictators, are all looking at the army view, army view, army view. And the army view is just one view, right? Musharraf knows how to attack Kargil. He doesn't know how to be a diplomat, right? He doesn't know how the economy works. So, you know, we are in any organization, right? We are going for specialist, 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 right? But the ultimate decision maker has to realize what is good for the entire organization. And that was Narasimha Rao, right? And that's another reason why he felt that even though Manmohan Singh knew more about him than in finance, A.N. Verma, who was a former industry secretary, understood industries very well. K.N. Venugopal, Yugandhar, understood welfare scheme. He was the only person who had the keys to all kingdoms. And decisions required that.
Very, very interesting. And we've spoken a lot about the decisions Narasimha Rao made. And sometimes, even in the book, you talk about the fact that not making a decision is a decision itself.
Yeah.
And Narasimha Rao, in a lot of ways, mastered the art of not making a decision,
yeah,
in a strategic way.
Yeah.
So talk to us a little bit about that notion in the context of Narasimha Rao.
See, you know, Narasimha Rao made a lot of fun of, because the typical view of Narasimha Rao was, look, he's a scholar, but he doesn't act. And that's just a straight untruth. As I show in the book, you know, yes, he was a scholar, but at heart, he was a man of action, right? What he also was acutely aware of his political vulnerabilities. So when he didn't act, it was not because he didn't want to act, and not because, not acting was important, but because he just lacked the political ability, right? Sometimes it was that not acting is important, right? Not making a decision is important, right? But very often he just lacked the political ability that he could have made the decision. You know, he could have made the decision to privatize Air India, right? Which today we're trying to do. But at that time he would have lost his job. So he didn't make a decision on the matter, right? So the stereotype of Narasimha Rao is, which comes from that idea, you know, analysis until paralysis, that would be the joke. And the joke was Narasimha Rao knew how to be silent in 10 languages, right? And I think that misses, you know, something at the core of Narasimha Rao, that he was a man of action, right? But he was also acutely aware that, you know, as the book points out, he lacked power. So his genius was he knew where to act, under which political cover, and when he lacked political cover, he would withdraw. And it's a fine art, right? Because most politicians, you would argue, only care about survival. Narasimha Rao cared about survival, but he also cared about other things.
The other thing, Vinay, especially in politics, is often leaders have to take decisions where there's short-term pain, but there is gain over the long term. But people often don't see that. People often experience the short-term pain with greater intensity than they see the upside over the longer term. So what can we learn from Narasimha Rao about moving on those kinds of situations?
Well, I think first is, you know, it's important before I answer this, that just to get to the fact of what you've said, like, it's indisputable today, you know, so many years after liberalization, that, you know, the changes that Narasimha Rao brought about, you know, were unpopular in the short term, but have brought long-term gain to India. That's a fact, right? On the economy, for example, real incomes across percentiles have increased. The poorest Indian is less poor thanks to Narasimha Rao and the policies that followed after. It's not just Narasimha Rao. It's also the Devegowda, Vajpayee, Manmohan Singh regimes. But the shift that he made, right? The same you can say about foreign policy. India is a greater power today than it was in the 80s. It's a fact. Straight up fact, right? You can say that about welfare schemes. India has better welfare schemes today. It has better schemes on health, education. It has certainly more money to deal with these problems than it had, you know, before 1991. So the fact of the matter is that the policies of Narasimha Rao were unpopular in the short term, but have proven beneficial, especially to India's poor in the long term, right? There is a debate on whether inequality has increased. I think the answer is yes. Certain kinds of inequality has increased. It's not alarming at the global level. I think that's a just conversation to have. But we have moved from a situation in which broadly everybody had nothing to eat, when today there is inequality in what people have to eat. And I think that's a fair criticism. But to just talk about that without focusing on the fact that there have been long-term benefits was one of the points of this book, because I think there's a lot of misinformation which is not based on looking at evidence, right? The question was, you know, how did he get buy-in? And the short answer is he didn't. Narasimha Rao felt, and I think he was right in this judgment, that in the short term, Indian voters would punish him. So he chose to lie, right? He chose to be a fox. He would do economic reforms while pretending he was doing nothing. He would say, you know, what am I doing? It's just the IMF, right? Like, he's the only politician I can think of who did something good, but went to extraordinary efforts to hide his fingerprints because it was, you know, unpopular in the short term. In Congress working committee meeting after meeting, when congressmen would be shouting at him saying, you're going away from socialist Nehru, he would say, don't look at me, look at Dr. Saab, Dr. Manmohan Singh, he's the man with the PhD, right? So he would make what was fundamentally an ideological choice sound like, you know, medicine that has to be administered in a clinical, non-political way by a doctor to a patient, right? I think that is genius. So in the so the simple answer to your question is he didn't buy in. He didn't trust the Indian voter to try to sell this to them, right? Instead, he lied. He pretended that nothing has changed, right? And in the 1996 elections, he campaigned on the basis of his welfare schemes, not on the basis of economic reforms, and he lost. So the Indian voter has not bought in or did not buy into Narasimha Rao's changes. If they had, he would have been re-elected, right? I think that what he did was arguably correct at that point because it was unpopular and he was too weak to attempt to build a constituency over something that was short-term unpopular given how little power he had. But I think the tragedy has been that many politicians have learned from Narasimha Rao that, look, make changes in India, do economic reform, right? Do foreign policy changes, but don't talk about it. You know, keep it quiet. And I think that that has been one of the negative consequence, that the lack of getting popular buy-in to something that has so obviously brought long-term benefits. I mean, I'm not saying that liberalization has solved all problems in India, but it now has created a qualitatively different set of problems than what we had before 1991. But I think that that's a mistake that Narasimha Rao made, inevitable and necessary perhaps at the time, but something that has left a poisonous legacy.
But that's with the benefit of hindsight, maybe just to pressure test that, when you're at the point of making the decision, how do you convey the 20-year upside on day zero?
Well, you know, I can think of so many politicians, Churchill being the most classic example, Park Chung-hee in South Korea being the other big example, Lee Kuan Yew being the other example, who say that, look, I'm taking a poor country on this modernizing journey. They're going to be short-term pains. But I can assure you this with some guarantee that your children will have better lives than you do. It takes a certain kind of politician. It has been done, right? But that politician has to have a mandate, has to have the trust of the people. And only then can, you know, the voter say, I'll undergo some pain for you because I know my child's life will be better. Narasimha Rao was an unknown. You know, he had the charisma, as I repeatedly say, of a dead fish. Nobody had heard of him, you know, even after he became prime minister, a few people had heard of him, right? I can tell you that, you know, when I went to Hyderabad, to meet the Narasimha Rao family for the first time, around 2015, And I asked my taxi guy, have you heard of Narasimha Rao? You know, I'm going to his family's house. He's saying, oh yeah, he's the guy after whom that flyover is named. He didn't know who he was, right? So a man like this could not, I don't think, would have been able to take, you know, the Indian people along. And I think that he was well aware of that weakness of his, that he would not be remembered. I mean, I can tell you that, you know, before my book came out, I remember talking to a friend of mine who was doing a PhD on India in an Ivy League university. And he was doing a PhD in political science. And I said, look, I'm writing this book on Narasimha Rao. And my friend said, who's he? Right? And this is an academic working on contemporary India, right? So a man like that is not going to lead Indians into saying that, you know, Modi is trying it. Let's see whether it works or not. But Narasimha Rao, no way he would have succeeded. And I think he was realistic enough to know that. So on hindsight, I think he made the right judgment call for his survival at the time.
Vinay, thanks for the very insightful conversation. This podcast is titled Play to Potential, which is about people having coherent responses to the two questions, where to go and how to grow as they navigate their career. In summary, any takeaways for our listeners on what we can learn from Narasimha Rao in addressing these two questions?
Well, I think Narasimha Rao knew the what, but he also knew the how. And I think that's really important. I think that's the one thing that, you know, I'm in the beginning of my career, right? So I'm asking myself, what do I learn from Narasimha Rao? And that is, if you want to do something, how do you go about it? You got to know your ecosystem. You got to know the DNA of your organization, right? When your boss changes, you got to know the DNA of the new boss. You got to realize when you have a mandate and when you don't. You know, you got to realize, you know, when your boss is saying something, is the boss actually giving you the power to do what you want or not? And within that realm of the real, how do you put through what you want to do is, I think, the key lesson of Narasimha Rao.
Very interesting. And maybe just to add to that, what I find fascinating is he seemed like a reasonably introverted kind of a man, given the way you describe him. So to be so perceptive, despite being introverted, is just a fascinating paradox for me as I think about him and how he's led his life.
Yeah. In fact, in the book, I say this is the, you know, there's this, you know, this famous essay, you know, by this Russian writer who says that the two great figures in, you know, in modern fiction is Don Quixote and Hamlet, right? You know, Hamlet is somebody who thinks so much he can't act. You know, Don Quixote is someone who acts without thinking, right? And Narasimha Rao at his best merged both, right? You know, he was somebody who was thinking and somebody who was acting, you know, and that's what's remarkable about him. He was a scholar as well as he was a politician. You know, so he was an introvert, but he also knew how to act, right? I mean, he was somebody who was not very comfortable spending time with, you know, with people. But here we have it. He was a politician who met hundreds of people a day, right? And I think that essential contradiction of being half a lion is what made him work. I mean, he was exactly the kind of contradictory figure that India needed in the 90s. And this mix of being Don Quixote and Hamlet, in the best sense of the word, is what caused India to change.
Got it. Vinay, thanks so much for your time. Pleasure talking to you.
Thanks very much.
Hope you found the conversation as purposeful as I did. It's just fascinating to see the journey of Narasimha Rao from Vangara, a village in Telangana, to becoming the Prime Minister of the country. There were three big takeaways for me in this conversation. First is the unfettered curiosity of Narasimha Rao. If we take languages, his mother tongue was Telugu and he spoke good Marathi. He spoke 8 other Indian languages, and on top of that, he spoke English, French, Arabic, Spanish, German, and Persian. I just want to pause here for a minute. This is just mind-boggling by any standards. On top of that, Vinay talks about him learning COBOL, BASIC, and UNIX when he discovers the world is changing. This attitude to learning, in a lot of ways, represents the mindset with which CEOs of today need to approach how they spend time. What I also found interesting was the insight from Vinay that these learning habits kept Narasimha Rao occupied when he was not in power and kept him away from doing silly things that could damage the long-term outcomes. It kept him out of trouble. That was an interesting perspective. The second takeaway is the notion of staying agile in the context of the situation. A couple of instances come to mind from what Vinay says. The first is that Narasimha Rao almost became a monk in Kutralam. But when he hears the news of Rajiv Gandhi's assassination, he realizes that he might have a future in Delhi, and he's there the next day. The second is Narasimha Rao changing his protectionist stance to reconsidering his view towards opening up the economy, given the balance of payments crisis that we faced at that time.
What I also liked about the notion of agility is the nuance that Vinay brings about by distinguishing between intellectual agility and implementation agility, and the fact that Narasimha Rao was great at both. The third piece that struck me was the extent to which Narasimha Rao thought through the how, not just the what, when it came to problem solving around a situation and coming up with an approach. More specifically, really knowing the constraints around you and coming up with a solution that's realistically plausible given the limited control and mandate you have is so, so important. And that sense of judgment is a fine art indeed. Thank you for listening. If you find the content in the podcast purposeful, please share with those that could find this of value, and do take a moment to rate and review on iTunes. For more content from leaders like Nandini Nilekani, Zia Modi, Vinita Bali, Jay Panda, Vishy Anand, Atul Kasbekar, Amish Tripathi and more, do visit playtopotential.com and sign up on the website to be intimated when we upload new content. You could access a full conversation or access content that's curated by key themes that might be of interest to you. Some of the curated playlists include topics like resilience, reinventing yourself, mindfulness, redefining the notion of success, and more. I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. Signing off, this is Deepak Jayaraman. To know more about the transition advisory work I do, please visit www.transitioninsight.com. Bye now.